Hey, everybody, and welcome to the Billboard Pop Shop Podcast. I'm Keith Caulfield, Senior Director of Charts at Billboard.
And I'm Jason Lipschutz, Billboard's Senior Director of Music.
Hello, Jason. How are you?
What's going on?
You know, just the typical, over here in Pop Shop land, it's just, the pops are shining and the shops are growing. Everything's doing well. Yeah.
That sounds industrious. I love it.
Yeah. You know how we are in the Pop Shop. Well, as always, the Billboard Pop Shop Podcast is your, I don't know what that means, but whatever. The Pop Shop Podcast is your one-stop shop for all things pop on Billboard's weekly charts. In addition, you can always count on a lively discussion about the latest pop news, fun chart stats and stories, new music, and guest interviews with music stars and folks from the world of pop. Today on the show, we've got chart news about how BTS scores their first number one on the Billboard Hot 100 Songs chart with Dynamite, and how Taylor Swift's Folklore ties for the most weeks at number one on the Billboard 200 Albums chart in 2020. But can she break that tie next week?
We'll see what happens. Plus, we'll catch up on the action that took place on Sunday night at the MTV Video Music Awards and chat about new music from Dua Lipa, Blackpink and Selena Gomez, Calvin Harris and The Weeknd, and Christina Aguilera. But first, before we get started, if you enjoy the podcast, subscribe.
I would hope so.
You co-host it. Subscribe to the show on your favorite podcast provider so you never miss an episode. And if you want to explore more podcasts from Billboard, visit billboard.com/podcasts. That is plural. Keith, first, before we get into the chart chat, let's talk for a second about the MTV Video Music Awards. Lady Gaga took home the most wins of the night, 5, including Artist of the Year, but it was The Weeknd's Blinding Lights that grabbed the biggest trophy of the evening for Video of the Year. So, we covered the MTV VMAs last night. I thought, honestly, it was a pretty lively show.
Lively in quotes. Lively.
Well, here's the thing. And I was talking about it with one of my colleagues, one of our colleagues earlier today. It's a really hard show to have the VMA, or it's a really hard year to have the VMAs, because on the one hand, the VMAs are kind of known for pushing the envelope and
anything can happen,
crazy.
Mishaps on stage,
shock value, and
Miley
then
Cyrus grinds herself on Robin Thicke,
Exactly. And then you juxtapose that with a really somber year, with a pandemic, with a civil rights movement. And also, just in terms of this past weekend, you have a huge Hollywood star, Chadwick Boseman, passing away and really shocking the world. So it was a very strange time to kind of be opening, like be entering VMAs mode. But I honestly think they handled it really well. There were a lot of pointed political speeches and performances. You had DaBaby performing atop a cop car next to a sign that said "Stop Killing Us." You had The Weeknd saying "Justice for Breonna Taylor" and "Justice for Jacob Blake" when accepting Video of the Year. So, honestly, there was some of that kind of eyebrow-raising VMAs content, from
not in the traditional sense that we've become accustomed to with the VMAs, though, because it just, someone in Rage Against the Machine, or was it Limp Bizkit, crawling on like a piece of like the set that
oh, it was a Rage Against the Machine protesting the win of Limp Bizkit.
Oh, okay. Well, at least I got the players correct. But yeah, I mean, with everything that's going on, combined with, as you said, like the VMAs, which are always supposed to be like cheeky and crazy and anything can happen. It's like, it's never meant to be like a serious show. For them to kind of have to make a serious show and then have to deal with, a death of an incredibly important star right before the show, that's very hard in terms of production. It reminds me vaguely of the Grammy Awards earlier this year when, like, the day of the show, Kobe died.
Yeah.
And that kind of, and at the venue where the Lakers played at Staples Center, I mean, he didn't die there, but that's where the Lakers played and that's where the Grammys were. And it just adds a completely different dynamic to the proceedings. But I mean, all in all, I thought there were some really interesting highlights in terms of the performances. Were any of the performances actually performed on Sunday night, or were they all pre-taped? Because they all looked kind of pre-taped to me. I mean, The Weeknd's performance was clearly pre-taped days beforehand.
I think that a couple of them were live. I could be wrong in that, and I believe that someone on our team is speaking to an executive producer on the show. Check billboard.com for that, because that is probably up already on the site by the time you're listening to this. But I think that in the same way that I couldn't tell, I guess that speaks more clearly to its success, because, you know, there were obviously some that were pre-taped, but the flow of the show I thought was strong enough that it kept me engaged. And, you know, in my mind, watching CNCO perform to a bunch of cars as like a socially distanced kind of concert. And then also Lady Gaga, who I thought had the performance of the night, with not only Rain on Me with Ariana Grande sharing a stage in Face Mask, but also a really powerful medley of Chromatica songs during a year in which everybody, including myself, was looking forward to a Chromatica tour that just is not going to happen
in 2021.
Yeah, I mean, you know, seeing her perform Stupid Love and 911 and Rain on Me was really exciting. So I think they made the most of a tough situation.
Well, there's a lot to say. I could talk about this forever, but we should probably move on. Okay, let's do the chart chat. First up on the Billboard Hot 100 Songs chart, to the surprise of probably nobody, BTS smashes in at number one with the group's first chart topper. Dynamite, I guess I should say, explodes in at number one, but that might have been too obvious. The new single, which is also the South Korean boy band's first all-English language track, debuts atop the list with some eye-popping sales figures. The song sold 300,000 copies in the US in the week ending August 27th, according to Nielsen Music MRC data, of course. That hefty number was assisted by the availability of four different versions of the song on digital services, as well as two physical singles, a 7-inch vinyl, and a cassette single. How old-fashioned. I'm waiting for the 8-track single. I half kid, but who knows, that could happen. Actually, 8-tracks weren't meant... They didn't do 8-track singles back in the day, I don't think. It was only for albums. Anyway, Dynamite also did well in streaming activity. Jason's just nodding his head on the other side of the
Zoom. I don't know. I have no 8-track... memory.
It predates you. The song also did well in streaming. It garnered 32.1 million in U.S. streams. It also drew 11.6 million in radio airplay audience impressions in the week ending August 30th. The song, however, has yet to debut on the all-format radio songs chart. Jason, last week on the show, you were talking about how there were three big things left for BTS to achieve, at least sort of in the short term. A number one on the Hot 100, check. Their first huge radio hit, jury's out on that one at the moment, and their first Grammy Award nomination, check back later this year. So, Jason, you're 1 for 3 so far. What do you make of BTS's chances for Dynamite to become a huge radio hit and its chances of getting some Grammy love?
I think both are strong possibilities, and I think that, you know, over the weekend I heard Dynamite twice on Z100 in the New York area, and it sounds like it fits. It sounds like a really up-tempo pop song that kind of leans into this modern disco influence tinged pop revolution going on right now, and it's got a big hook, and I think that there's just going to be demand for this song at radio. When it comes to Grammys, I mean, I guess we'll see, but I just don't think you can count out a number one single on the Hot 100 for Grammy consideration, especially a track as strong as Dynamite. So, you know, like you said, one down, two to go, and we'll see what happens. But this is maybe the song that unlocks a whole bunch of new territory for BTS.
Does the song remind you of anything? Because when I heard it the first time, it reminded me, it sounded like sort of kind of like disco meets uptown funk, sort of. Like, it felt like it was purposely echoing kind of like disco funk vibes, but not trying to rip anyone off. I think it just had that kind of aura to it.
Yeah, I was talking to our colleague Andrew Unterberger earlier today, and he described it as wedding music. And I think that's Exactly correct.
In a good way. In a good
way. Yeah, in a good way. I think that you listen to it and exactly, Uptown Funk. You hear I Got a Feeling by Black Eyed Peas. Like I think
Celebration by Kool & the Gang.
Yeah, and I think that's obviously it sounds a little bit different than all of those, but I do think that this is a song meant to soundtrack celebrations.
Yeah. All right, well, we'll see. I mean, I'm sure the BTS Dynamite is not going anywhere, so I'm sure we'll be talking about it a whole lot in the future. So next up over on the Billboard 200 albums chart, Taylor Swift's Folklore spends a fifth straight week at number one, tying Little Baby's My Turn for the most weeks atop the list in 2020. Folklore further becomes the first album to rule for 5 weeks in a row at number one since Drake's Scorpion logged its first five frames at number one back in 2018. Little Baby's My Turn was number one for 5 weeks in total, but that was a debut at number one in 1 week, and then it went away from number one, and then it came back for 4 weeks in a row. So, you know, we'll see if Taylor can hold on for another week. In the meantime, let me just rattle off some figures for you. Folklore earned 98,000 equivalent album units in the U.S. in the week ending August 27th. That's down 3%. Of course, according to Nielsen Music MRC data. So if Folklore is number one for a sixth week, it will have the most weeks at number one for any album since Drake's Views tallied 13 weeks at number one back in 2016. So that's kind of a big deal. Yeah. Further, Folklore would also be the first album with 6 weeks in a row at number one since Views, which spent its first 9 weeks at number one. And I'm not going to forecast anything now, but I wouldn't be incredibly surprised if Folklore got a 6 week at number one. I'll leave it at that.
See what happens.
Dun, dun, dun.
Keith, let's switch gears.
Okay.
Talk about some new releases that dropped last Friday, including new tunes from Dua Lipa, Blackpink, and Selena Gomez, Calvin Harris and The Weeknd, and Christina Aguilera. Also, I wanted to we haven't talked about Katy Perry's Smile album yet.
See, I was going to put that in here, but I wasn't sure if we had already sort of like talked too much about it. So thank you for correcting me, for making sure.
Well, I'll spend 30 seconds on Smile, which is, I think that this is the album in which Katy Perry, and it's funny because last week was the 10-year anniversary of Teenage Dream, which obviously had 5 number one singles on the Hot 100. I think that this is the album in which Katy Perry, who is a perennial kind of Hot 100 chart-topping presence, or at least, you know, top 10 presence over the past decade, is starting to pivot. And I think she's doing it in a smart way in which she's kind of exploring, you know, obviously you have the trap pop of a dark horse on one of the tracks. You have sort of the kind of disco influence of 2020, but you also have some adult contemporary songs. Thinking of a song like Only Love, What Makes a Woman, which is a great closer on the album. And then you have Never Really Over leading the
never
album.
Really over, da, 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 never really over. Like, that should have been a much bigger hit.
Yeah, I mean, I looked it up. I thought it was lower than it did, but it did peak at number 15, which is a respectable peak. But it great song, co-produced by Zedd. I will say, the last thing I'll say about it, I did tweet this last week, Justice for Small Talk, my favorite recent Katy Perry song, which is just a bonus track on Smile. What's going on there? Great song. Let's move on to Dua Lipa's remix album, Club Future Nostalgia. It sports new dance floor ready reworkings of songs from her Future Nostalgia set less than 5 months after it was released. A couple curveballs, like remixes of two previously unreleased tracks, Love is Religion and That Kind of Woman. I think this is a really fun remix album. It's obviously following pretty closely on the heels of actual Future Nostalgia, which, speaking of the Grammys, I do think is going to get some Grammy consideration. But I think it's really fun. There's the stakes are very low. It's just basically like Dua saying, like, I wanted to make this a little bit more club friendly and record a new version of Levitating with Madonna and Missy Elliott, and hit up Mark Ronson and Gwen Stefani, and you know, it's very fun. What do you think of it?
One, I think it's cool that an artist of her stature is doing something like this, because this is kind of unconventional. I mean, this used to be something that would happen, like back in the day. Like, I remember Madonna put out a remix album called You Can Dance. And then Paula Abdul had one. Bobby Brown had one. I mean, that was kind of a thing in, like, the late 80s, early 90s, where it, as a stopgap between projects, they would put out a remix album. But this is different. This is, like, a thematic album where they're turning future nostalgia into basically, like, a continuous in the mix sort of thing, where if you play all the songs just continuously, there's no real breaks, so to speak. I mean, there are technically track breaks, but it plays as one moment. You could play it as if you were in a club, and you have to think of the album in that way when you listen to it. And it's interesting when you look at the comments on the remixes on, say, YouTube, there's a lot of fans that are critiquing the songs where I feel like they were expecting something else than what they actually should have been expecting. Like, they're like, oh, I don't like the way this remix sounds, and she should have redone the vocal, and why? And I'm like, I don't understand why their expectations were not more managed. Because when you listen to it, to me, it sounds like, oh, these are like dance club mixes. They're club mixes. They're not like top 40 mixes. So I don't know. I think it's cool.
I do think you're right that it is a kind of older concept.
Yeah.
Club mixes of tracks, and people aren't used to their favorite artists kind of co-signing this in such a way as a full length. You don't really see that often. Anyway, let's move on to Ice Cream, Blackpink and Selena Gomez's new single, which I wrote about last week. I spoke to a couple people over at Interscope who did this huge marketing blitz for the song. Selena Gomez partnered with Serendipity, the gourmet ice cream brand, for her own brand of ice cream, Cookies and Cream Remix. Keith, I was sent a pint of Cookies and Cream Remix.
Did it come with a download of the song inside the ice cream?
Absolutely.
Was it an ice cream song bundle?
An ice cream bundle. Yeah. Before it melts. I will say this is not SponCon. This is not sponsored content. I did greatly enjoy the Cookies and Cream remix.
Had no impact on your editorial coverage whatsoever.
Absolutely not. I don't even think I wrote that anywhere that I really liked the ice cream. But anyway.
Anyway.
There was also
what do you think of the song? What do you think of the,
I just wanted to mention an ice cream truck was driving around Los Angeles. It was in your neck of the woods, Keith. Selena Gomez Blackpink ice cream truck was driving around Los Angeles over the weekend playing a MIDI version of Ice Cream, which was pretty cool. Anyway, song's pretty cool. I think that it is going to be Blackpink's biggest hit in the US. It's very modern sounding in terms of kind of intermixing singing, some kind of yawning beats, some rapping. It's very kind of like TikTok friendly, and I think it's the right song for them.
So do you think, like, it feels like Blackpink has been like percolating for a while now, like waiting in the wings behind BTS, so to speak. Blackpink had a moment, like a low-key moment with Sour Candy with Lady Gaga on the Chromatica album. That wasn't a single, but now we have Blackpink and Selena Gomez together. Is this going to be potentially the song that really breaks them, you know, especially considering that they have an album right around the corner?
Yeah, I think so, and that's the key, because their album comes out in October, and they needed this sort of big look before this album comes out, because they released this. So Sour Candy came out in May, right before Chromatica came out, and peaked at number 33 on the Hot 100. That's great. I mean, it's a top 40 hit for them. How You Like That is the lead single from their new album. That also peaked at number 33 on the Hot 100. And again, that's great for a new artist, but also it's not what they wanted. They wanted that song to cross over in a much bigger way in the U.S. So now you have not only this big song with Selena Gomez, but this huge kind of marketing push around this. It comes in right before the Grammy eligibility period on August 31st, and right before Blackpink's album comes out. So I think like the social interest in this song, combined with, you know, the fan base is coming together, because Selena Gomez is a huge, huge star and does not guest. And, you know, when she does guest on tracks, like she makes Wolves with Marshmello, she makes huge It hit. Ain't Me with Kygo. They're hits. She doesn't have that many kind of featuring Selena Gomez songs that kind of fizzle. So this was like an all out offense in terms of getting Blackpink on more people's radars, not only in the US, but around the world. So I think that you look back to Billboard had its cover with Blackpink about a year and a half ago, February 2019. They performed at Coachella, April 2019. They've been working on this new music. Obviously, we'll see how that the album does in general, but this is a big look for them, and I think that this was the kind of smart decision to go all out on this song and almost ensure a big breakout moment. And I do think that the song rises to the occasion. Really quickly, because we got to wrap up, Calvin Harris and The Weeknd dropped a new track, Over Now, which I quite liked. It's very low-key. It's kind of like lounge music, but, you know.
I checked the credits. It's not sampling anything, apparently, but it has echoes of Regulate, a.k.a. Michael McDonald's, I keep forgetting, in there.
Yeah.
So smart move, Calvin and Weeknd.
Yeah, I think it's a pretty cool song. It doesn't sound like a hit, but you know what?
The Weeknd's
still in the top five. Jason. Well, it doesn't. It doesn't sound designed for a hit. And I give Calvin Harris credit for just kind of doing his whole thing this year with his Love Regenerator project. He's like, yo, you guys are expecting kind of up-tempo radio hits for me. Like, I'm going to be as experimental as possible. And a lot of that stuff's really good. Lastly, Christina Aguilera dropped her new version of the Mulan song Reflection from the new live-action version of the Disney animated film. Of course, Aguilera first recorded Reflection for the animated version of the movie way back in 1998. Now she's back. This was before Genie in a Bottle, Keith.
Yeah.
I wish that this version of Mulan had all the music, because that 1998 soundtrack
is
flames, man. True to Your Heart, 98 Degrees. Osmond.
Let's get down to business.
Yeah.
What's the You'll Make a Man Out of Me? What's the song that you love?
I'll Make a Man Out of You.
Yeah, that one.
I'll make a man out of you.
Jason full-on loves the Mulan. He's not joking. He actually really
truly
loves it.
No, I love it. Yeah, Honor to Us All is a great song. Yeah, I mean, the whole thing is top-notch.
Yeah. Okay, well, segue now to the chart stat of the week. Hey! This week in 2012, Taylor Swift got her first number one on the Hot 100 with We Are Never Ever Getting Back Together. The song vaulted from its debut at number 72 to number one in its second week on the chart dated September 1st, 2012. It spent a total of 3 non-consecutive weeks atop the list. The track was the lead single from Swift's album Red, which also topped the Billboard 200 chart. Swift scored 3 more top 10 Hot 100 hits from the album: Begin Again, the title track, and I Knew You Were Trouble When You Walked In. Since getting it together at number one, Swift has charted 5 more number ones with Shake It Off, Bad Blood, featuring Kendrick Lamar, of course, Blank Space, Look What You Made Me Do, and this year's Cardigan. So there you have it. This week in 2012, Taylor Swift got her first number one on the Hot 100 with We Are Never Ever Getting Back Together. Alrighty, we've reached the end of our big shoe. What song should we go out on, Jason?
Let's do Begin Again. Great, great Taylor Swift song.
Alrighty, and we'll see you next time. Bye! But on a Wednesday in a cafe, I watched it begin.